This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There are 14,000 publicly traded companies in the U.S. My guest Alex Berenson says that expecting all of them to be honest is unrealistic. But by the start of the 21st century, all manner of companies were abusing accounting rules to mislead their investors, seemingly without fear of being caught. In his new book, Berenson investigates the accounting methods many companies have used to help them publish profitable but misleading and inaccurate quarterly earnings reports. Berenson is a business reporter for the New York Times and a former reporter for the Denver Post and thestreet.com. His new book is called The Number. The number refers to the most important number in a company's quarterly earnings report, the bottom line figure of the earnings per share. It's a number investors are obsessed with, and Berenson says it represents the short-term mindset that infected Wall Street and corporate America in the late 90s. I asked him to explain how the number is calculated.
The base number, the number that the company reports, is its actual earnings, what its sales were, what its costs were. You sort of net those two things out. You subtract costs from sales and you get profits. And right now, actually, we're in the middle of corporate earnings season. Companies like GE and like Microsoft are reporting their profits right now, saying we made, you know, X billion dollars in the first quarter and we have, Y billion shares outstanding. So it works out that we made 25 cents a share, or we made 63 cents a share. And then Wall Street looks at that number and compares it to what analysts had forecast as earnings would be. So, for example, if Microsoft made 25 cents a share and the estimate was 22 cents a share, everyone says, oh, this is wonderful. This is a great quarter for the company. The future is bright. It's a new day dawning. Buy, you know, buy, buy, buy. And the stock goes up. It can go up significantly. Certainly in the late 90s, stocks often went up very significantly if you beat your estimates. And then if the estimate was 28 cents and they report 25 cents, all of a sudden the sky is falling and the company stock can be absolutely penalized. And, you know, if this happens too many quarters in a row, suddenly, the CEO is out and it's time for a change.
Now, you say that although the number is used by investors and it's considered to be very important, it's a lie. In what sense is it a lie?
Well, it's a lie because it's very hard for a company to actually calculate its earnings over any three-month period. It's a lie because you have to – people imagine that, well, I know how much I make and I know broadly how much I spend. So I know whether I'm saving money or whether I'm, you know, going deeper into debt. And so it should be pretty easy for a big company to do the same thing. In reality, the level of detail and complexity that goes into a corporate earnings report, a quarterly corporate earnings report, is almost unfathomable to the average person. You have to estimate hundreds and hundreds of different variables. You have to determine whether or not you actually made a sale, whether you actually got paid, whether, you know, the truck that you own went down in value by $500 or $700, and, you know, you multiply that by 20,000 trucks and all of a sudden you're talking about some real money. And so to believe that a company knows to the penny, you know, or to the, you know, even to the $1 million if it's GE, exactly what it made in a quarter is a lie. And people used to, I think, understand that a bit more because it used to be that analysts estimated earnings within a range. They would say, well, a company's going to make $1.90 to $2 this quarter. And so if the company made $1.91, it was okay. If the company made $1.99, it was okay. But when you have a consensus estimate, you can't have a consensus range estimate. You have to have a consensus estimate that's to a point, to a penny. And so it became, well, Wall Street thinks the company's going to make $1.94 this quarter. And all of a sudden, if you made $1.92, it wasn't so good. And if you made $1.97, things were great, which is a silly way to think about things. But unfortunately, people, investing is complicated and difficult, and people like sort of simple maxims. And this became the overriding maxim. Did you make your number? Did you meet estimates? Are things good or bad? And so there was increasing growing pressure on companies to make sure they did make their numbers. And because there's variability in accounting, because it's fairly simple in any one quarter to make a minor adjustment here or there so you can make sure you made your estimate, then companies did start to cheat. And companies that were cheating already cheated more.
And when you say cheating, you in part mean creative accounting.
I mean, there's all kinds of cheating, but yes, I mean selling stuff when you don't actually think you're going to get paid, but counting it as a sale and booking a profit from it. I mean, marking up your pension fund more than you actually can make on it and booking that as a profit. There's dozens, literally dozens of major ways that companies can play with the rules. There's something called GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles. But within GAAP, there's a lot of variability, and there's stuff that is in the gray area of GAAP, and there's stuff that's clearly beyond GAAP, and then there's stuff that's, you know, probably illegal, you know, not just a violation of GAAP, but really a violation of the securities laws. And then there's stuff that's definitely illegal. So there's a wide continuum. But I would say that almost every company by the late 90s was at least pushing the boundaries of GAAP.
Accounting is in some ways an exact science. You know, it's an empirical approach to figuring out profits and losses. On the other hand, there's a lot of subjectivity in actually making those evaluations when you're talking about big corporate accounting. And one of the areas where there is a lot of subjectivity within the analysis is in something called accrual accounting. Can you explain what accrual accounting is and why so many corporations really need to use accrual accounting?
Sure. Just about every big company uses accrual accounting because what it is supposed to do is match your expenses and your sales, not based on when the cash comes in, but based on when a sale is actually made or when you actually have an expense related to a specific product. So what you're trying to do is give people a real picture of how the business is running, because there are going to be times when you're appearing to be profitable when you're actually spending cash. I mean, and in fact, when you're going to be profitable, but your cash is flowing out because, let's say, you're building a new plant because demand is so big for that new car you just introduced. Well, you have to spend money for that plant. So if you were just counting cash flow, it would look like you were losing money. But that's not actually what's going on in the reality of the business. The reality of the business is that things are good and you're making money. And that's what accrual accounting is supposed to measure. People generally think about their own finances on a cash basis. The cash comes in, you know, and fairly rapidly it flows out. It flows out to credit card companies, or it flows out to a restaurant. And you get paid on a monthly or a weekly or a biweekly basis. So it's pretty easy for you to match your cash flows. But for companies, it's a lot more complicated, and accrual accounting is supposed to measure that complexity. Unfortunately, it is an art as well as a science, because sometimes it's not clear that you've made a sale that you're going to get paid for. Sometimes you might be talking to a customer and they say, well, we'll take your product and we think we're going to buy it, but we want to test it out and, you know, we want the ability to return it. Well, that is not really a sale, you know, under any accounting, under accrual accounting. You shouldn't book that as a sale. But if you're short on your quarter and that one sale might get you there, you might say, well, let's count that as a sale, and we'll just write our customer a letter saying, you know what, you can return that if you want. We'll give you a letter on the side, but we won't put that in the contract, and we'll tell the accountants that's a sale. That's the kind of thing that shouldn't happen, but does happen, and accrual accounting allows to happen.
We've been talking a little bit about creative accounting practices that sometimes cross the line and mislead investors. Who's supposed to be making sure that that doesn't happen, that the accounting and the quarterly reports are as accurate as possible?
Well, the two main outside groups that are supposed to keep an eye on things are the accounting industry itself, which is, you know, if you're a CPA, that means you're a certified public accountant, and theoretically you don't just have responsibility to the company, you have responsibility to the shareholders as well. And then the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, which was created in the 30s after the first, you know, sort of huge bubble and bust in American markets in the 20th century, the 1920s boom that led to the 29 crash that a lot of people felt led to the depression. So you have the SEC and you have the accounting industry. And unfortunately, neither of those groups is quite as strong as we all would have liked to think. The accounting industry has a big structural problem, and that is that it is paid by the company. It's hired by executives, it's paid by the company, and yet theoretically it's responsible to shareholders. And so it's really trying to serve two masters. And it's during the 90s, you definitely saw a change in accounting culture. Whereas in the, you know, in the, certainly in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, these really were guys with green eye shades. They didn't think of themselves as salesmen. They didn't like to have to go out and pitch business. By the 80s and certainly by the 90s, there was a new breed inside accounting firms. And some of these people were not even accountants at all. There were a lot of consultants at the firms. The firms had gotten a lot bigger. They'd gotten to be more like companies and less like partnerships. And so the traditional accountant was sort of overwhelmed. And, you know, when you're a consultant, your job is to sell. And the way you sell to your customer, you know, if your customer is an executive, is not by telling him, you can't do that. That is not allowed under generally accepted accounting principles. The way you do it is by saying, well, let's find a way to make this deal work. Let's find a way to make that transaction profitable for you. Let's find a way that you can do this and report a profit. And that happened a lot in the accounting industry in the 1990s. And I think only now are we seeing how badly the industry was corrupted from the inside. And only now, I think, are accountants beginning to say, we do have some professional responsibilities that maybe we didn't pay enough attention to in the late 90s. But honestly, I'm not seeing as much of it from the industry as I would like. You have not seen the CEOs of the major four accounting firms that remain talking about their responsibilities that much. You know, I think the accountants for 100 years have really tried to avoid facing this dilemma of being paid by companies while serving investors head on. And it's going to take a long time before they face up to it.
Now, what about the SEC? What is the SEC supposed to be doing to regulate financial reports and to make sure that they're accurate?
Well, the SEC is the last line of defense. The SEC, you know, its role is not to supervise every deal made by a public company. Its role is not to examine the books of every company every year. But its role is to make sure that in cases where there is fraud or where there is egregious behavior, that it steps in. Its role is to be the policeman of the securities markets. But unfortunately, the SEC just did not have the resources to carry that role out in the late 90s. It had 3,000 employees, which is twice as many employees as it had had 60 years before. And the markets are far larger and more complex than they were 60 years ago. They're far larger and more complex than they were 20 years ago. In addition, the SEC paid less than private law firms, than private accounting firms. And so, you know, really talented people at the SEC would say, well, I can make, you know, X at the SEC, or I can make 5X if I go work for a law firm. And eventually, that's a pretty hard decision to make, to sacrifice that so you can work for a government agency, especially if you feel like you're not getting the resources that you need to prosecute big cases. So by the late 90s, the SEC was pretty much overwhelmed. There's a great quote from a Republican congressman, I believe it was in 98 or 99, and he said, well, I think the SEC is doing a great job and doesn't need any more resources. Look at how many people are investing in the markets. To me, that's the same logic as saying, well, look at how many people are flying. Clearly, we can cut the FAA's budget. And yet, that was the logic of the late 90s.
We talked a little bit about accrual accounting and how that could be used, you know, kind of creatively to make it seem like you've made more profits than you really have. Can you just like run through quickly some of the other practices that you think contributed to the kind of faking of the number of the bottom line in the quarterly reports?
Sure. I mean, the two biggest are that companies counted a lot of their pension income as operating income. So that means essentially because the stock market was going up, companies were able to report stronger profits, and that obviously helped the stock market to continue to go up, you know, which sort of starts to smell like a Ponzi scheme. Another huge factor is stock options, and the fact that stock options are not counted as an expense. And people who really know accounting, like Warren Buffett, think that this is a joke, that stock options are certainly a compensation expense. They're given to employees because they're valuable. And it seems ludicrous that you wouldn't have to count that as an expense. And yet companies did not count it as an expense. And then there's a variety of smaller tricks companies can do. They can sort of try to capitalize expenses, which means you spend money now, but you say, well, this is really for the future, even if you can't really demonstrate any benefit in the future from it. but you just stick it on your balance sheet instead of counting it as an expense. And there's a lot of other smaller tricks companies can use. If I can go back to the stock options for just a second, though, to me, that is another major contributing factor to the rise in accounting fraud in the late 90s, because what stock options did is they very closely tied CEO pay and executive pay to the performance of stock price. And in one way, that's a good thing. You want your CEO to be thinking about his stock price a little bit. You don't want him to be making bad investments. You don't want him to be wasting shareholders' money. But when you have a situation where if the stock goes up for 1 year or 2 years, the CEO can make $50 million or $100 million, really life-changing amounts of money, then, you know, he or she's going to be incredibly tempted to do whatever is necessary to make sure that stock price goes up and stays up long enough for him to cash out. And I don't think it's any coincidence that the biggest frauds of the late 90s, the biggest accounting scams, are generally companies where the CEOs took home 50 or 100, or in some cases, several hundred million dollars from stock options.
What do you think investors can do to be more confident of the numbers on the quarterly reports?
You know, it's a hard question, because unless you have a CPA or a CFA, or you're a chartered financial analyst, it's pretty tough to go through all this stuff and read it with a fine-tooth comb. There's a few things you can do, though. You can make sure you're diversified so that, you know, your life savings is not all in one company, especially if it's the company that you work for. That's a really big mistake, you know, the people at Enron made, some people at Tyco made, people at other big companies where there's been accounting blowups have made, because in some cases the company is going to have to lay people off just at the same time its stock is going down. So that's a really bad thing, obviously, to have happen to you. You can also say to yourself, does what this company is doing make sense? You know, people with Enron could never really understand how it was making money, and yet they continue to invest in it. Tyco, which is a company that I've written about, is a roll-up. And roll-ups meaning that it bought a lot of smaller companies. It mainly grew by acquisition, not internally. And roll-ups have a long history of blowing up, because there's a lot of accounting games you can do whenever you buy a company. It's one of the easiest ways to cheat is in taking over another company. And yet, the guys from Tyco said, well, we do it differently. We're not like other conglomerates. We're not like other roll-ups. We really know how to run these businesses. And you have to ask yourself, you really know how to run five different kinds of businesses better than the existing management, and that's why your profits are so strong? You know, that story just didn't make sense. And yet, because the accounting profits were there, because Tyco was able to get its accounts to sign off and show a steadily rising earnings stream, people just bought it. And so if the business does not make sense to you, you should stay away from it. Now, naturally, sometimes that might cost you some money. You might not invest in some great company because, you know, it was a little more complicated than you could understand. But in the long run, investing is complicated, and it's your money, and you really need to be careful before you decide to put it into a company.
Is there any more regulation you would like to see the SEC do of accounting and reporting?
I would like to see the SEC be funded in a way that it can carry out its responsibilities. I think we have the structure in place, and we also have something new called the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, which was brought into law last year as part of Sarbanes-Oxley, the legislation that was passed over the summer of last year. And hopefully, Sarbanes-Oxley, which strengthened the penalties for companies that commit accounting fraud, and the Accounting Oversight Board, will combine to strengthen a system that is pretty strong as long as the resources are devoted to it. What's been fascinating to me about this is I don't consider myself an ideologue particularly, and yet my book has generated some heat from the right, because there's definitely a conservative ideology that the market is always right and that regulation is a mistake almost at any level. And, you know, I think we've had too much of that philosophy in the last few years. And I think regulation is an important part of making markets work. I think CEOs do respond to incentives. I think if they see a high risk of getting caught and relatively low rewards because they don't have huge stock options, they're less likely to cheat than if they see no risk of getting caught and huge rewards. And so I think what, as important as the regulatory structure, is having the resources to make that real. Otherwise, it's just sort of dusty laws that are not enforced.
Well, thank you so much for sharing some of the things you've learned in the past few years. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry, and thanks for having me on.
Alex Berenson is the author of the new book, The Number. He's a business reporter for The New York Times.